Okay, please be seated, everyone. And we'll go ahead and get started today. First of all, thank you all for being here. And what I'd like to do first is introduce the members of the Supreme Court. And I'll start with my, on my right, and we'll go across. On the far right here is Justice Michael Cherry. Next to Justice Cherry is Justice Ron Perigary. Associate Chief Justice Christina Pickering. Again, my name's Mark Gibbons. I'm the current Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. On my left is Justice Jim Hardesty, who will become Chief Justice in January of this coming year. Next to Justice Hardesty is Justice Michael Douglas. And at the end is Justice Nancy Seda. So again, it's our pleasure to be here and participate in oral arguments today. Also, I want to thank Julia Standish and Tom Standish, I mean, for starting this whole process about having us come to Palo Verde High School. Julia and Tom were visiting me in Carson City last spring, and I mentioned we do go to high schools probably once or twice a year with the Supreme Court, and they said, gee, we'd love to have you come to Palo Verde High School, and I said, well, guess what, my daughter is a graduate of Palo Verde High School, and she just graduated from law school and passed the bar exam. So anyway, I said, well, let's see if we can arrange that, and we were able to work out the details and come here to Palo Verde. So it's our pleasure to be here. As you can see, we have all seven members of the Supreme Court here today. Sometimes we hear cases with all seven of us, usually cases of significant legal precedent and all, so we can all hear them at the same time. But because of our workload, we have to divide most of our cases into panels of three of us, so only three would hear the cases, and then that will become relevant when we talk about the second case we have on for our argument today, and I'll wait till we get to it about how it got here for oral argument. But so that's kind of how it works, and anyway, what we'll do is when the arguments are done, we're going to answer questions about about how the Supreme Court operates and how we deliberate. We can't discuss these particular cases on what we're going to do with them because one of the reasons we have argument is none of us have decided what to do with these cases. We've read a lot of materials and all relating to them. That now what we do is we hear arguments from the attorneys for each side. Then we go back and discuss it and make a decision. And all our decisions are done in writing. It's a little different than what you see on TV judges that decide cases right away. We have to do everything in writing, and it usually takes at least 90 to 120 days before we can get our written decisions out. So anyway, hopefully there's enough seats here for all the students coming in, and we'll wait just one moment. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the attorneys for each side before we even start the clock for our oral arguments, because they'll take a half an hour, is we'll have them explain the cases, what these particular case is about to the students from their perspective. And then once they've done that, then we'll go ahead and start the clock, and we'll start in with the oral arguments for each side then. So I think the students are just about getting situated here. And this is certainly a beautiful auditorium. I think this is probably one of the largest ones we've ever been to around the state. And we've done oral arguments all around the entire state of Nevada over the past few years and all. So if we have okay, I think we just about everybody is seated here, so we'll go ahead and get started. And what we're going to do, this is a formal court session, so this is just like we're in the courtroom in either Carson City or Las Vegas. So I'll call the first case, which is case number 62585, which is the State of Nevada versus Edgar Banks. In this particular case, we have Jennifer Clemens from the Clark County District Attorney's Office representing the State of Nevada, and Danny Silverstein from the Clark County Public Defender's Office representing Mr. Banks. So what I'm going to do is ask Ms. Clemens if she could come up to the podium, maybe turn or you can face the audience and kind of explain this case on behalf of the State of Nevada and what your role is as a Deputy District Attorney, and we'll have Mr. Silverstein do the same afterwards.
Okay. My name is Jennifer Cummins. I'm a Chief Deputy District Attorney in the Clark County DA's office. I've been there for about 8 years. What I normally do is I'm normally in the regular courtroom prosecuting cases, trying trials, putting on hearings, things like that. This case came from a murder case that I had that the district court dismissed because the district court felt that the officers erred in destroying their handwritten notes regarding certain witnesses, and because of that destruction of notes, she felt that the case should be dismissed. And you'll hear my further arguments once we get started. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clemens. Mr. Silverstein, did you want to address the students and give your perspective on what we'll hear about this morning?
Thank you, Chief Justice. My name is Dan Silverstein. I'm an attorney at the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I'm attorney to the murder team in that office. I received this case about 3 years ago, and what happened is the police went out, they interviewed witnesses, all of the witnesses who had bad things to say about my client. Those statements were kept. All the witnesses who might have good things to say about my client, those notes were put in a paper shredder. I had asked for the notes. The prosecutor told me they had already been destroyed. That turned out to be a false representation. The district court was upset by that conduct and dismissed the case. And that brings us here.
Thank you very much. Also, I see here in the audience Phil Cohn, who's the Clark County Public Defender. Phil, if you could speak up. Phil's in charge of a very large office, which counsel for the respondents work for, and we appreciate him coming down to Palo Verde High School today as well for these oral arguments. So we'll go ahead and start with Ms. Clemens presenting her argument on behalf of the state of Nevada. She will be facing us for these arguments, and how this works is each side is given 15 minutes to argue the case. Now, because Ms. Clemens represents the appellant, she can divide her 15 minutes up between her opening argument, and she can save some of that 15 minutes to speak after Mr. Silverstein speaks. So that's what happens in any trial. Whoever has the burden of proof, whether it's in a trial and it's the plaintiff and the defendant, or the state of Nevada and the defendant, or in a civil case as well, whoever has the burden of proof gets to speak first and last whenever we have arguments before the court. So the same thing works here. So we'll go ahead and get started, Ms. Clemens. And would you like to reserve some of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Justice. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for
okay,
rebuttal.
So we'll reserve 3 minutes. And please keep an eye on the clock in front of you.
Yes.
And then we'll go ahead and hear from you, so you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. In this case, the dismissal of a murder information based upon the destruction of officer notes with interviews with pretty insignificant witnesses in this case, and also based upon a complete speculative nature that those notes contained exculpatory information, was a clear abuse of discretion by the district court. The district court's order was illogical, it was implausible, and it had no basis in the record. If we go back to the beginning, December 23rd of 2011, that's when the information or the criminal complaint was filed. That's the day that the respondent filed his motion to preserve in justice court. Respondent admits that he does this in every single murder case that he has, and that motion has no Nevada case law in it whatsoever. It's full of federal case law, which mainly addresses the Jenks Act. And since the 50 years that the Jenks Act was passed, we do not have a similar statute governing discovery. As justices are aware, discovery is mainly a statutory issue with the exclusion of Brady information. And if the legislature wants there to be a Jenks Act, then that's their job to create a Jenks Act to have us hold to the same standard as the federal government. But since we don't have a Jenks Act, it's improper for a district court to rely on cases that interpret that Jenks Act and apply it to state court. The justice court fully admitted it did not have jurisdiction to order the state to preserve the notes. There's been several cases out of this court that says justice court has no business basically interfering in discovery. They can't order things such as in a state v. justice court, the justice court attempted to order the victim of a sexual assault to undergo basically interviews and examinations by the defense expert. This court said that was improper. Also, in Mortensen v. State, it's a similar case in this case, but that was the one where there were two off-duty police officers that went to a neighborhood. One of the off-duty police officers killed somebody. In justice court, defense made a request to have all Brady material preserved, and the justice court there said, I can't order anything regarding this discovery, but I can tell the state, basically, you're on notice. That
also,
is exactly.
Does this rise to the level of fundamental fairness, giving them access when they've asked to have those notes preserved? Because, as the record indicates, the state was put on notice, and there may be a dispute as to when they were actually destroyed, but they were put on notice that they should retain that information, and it wasn't retained. So is it a fundamental fairness, a constitutional issue?
What kicks in terms of a constitutional issue is that if the if the respondent had put specific facts in this motion for this specific case indicating why he felt these notes were potentially exculpable, that would be a completely different situation.
Well, isn't that a problem when he doesn't even get a chance to review them prior to them being destroyed?
Well, at this point, he hadn't even reviewed a police report, so he had no basis to even come to the conclusion that there might be potentially
exculpatory. So is the state allowed to hide the ball in this process, the information they're going to rely on, and then only put forth the information they think is relevant in terms of putting forth their complaint or their charging document?
No, I wouldn't say we're allowed to hide the ball. What I would say is that because the respondent files this motion in every single case, and there's not, if there was specific facts saying, in this case, we think that these notes could be potentially exculpable, the state would have contacted the Metropolitan Police Department and said, you need to keep these. But when you file a blank stock motion that has no applicable law at all in every single case, what he's attempting to do is to change the policy of the police department. And that's not a duty or a power that he has. If the Justice Court had ordered us to preserve the notes, which we don't agree they have jurisdiction to do that, we would have called the detective to have them preserve the notes.
Well, you make a point of policy and the police department, but does the policy of the police department trump the Constitution and due process requirements?
If the respondent can show that the notes were the apparent exculpatory value at the time they were destroyed, then there's a duty to keep that evidence, but that was not done in this case. He made no findings or no evidence that the apparent exculpatory nature.
That's a classic catch-22. I can't see them, so I don't know whether there's exculpatory information in them. And I'm going to do what sounds like a pretty smart practice to me. I'm going to make an effort to preserve or have these records preserved. But then we're going to hold him out to have to be able to show, without any information whatsoever, why they need to be preserved. It's a catch-22. He can't see them. He can't preserve them. But now we're holding him to some legal standard that says he has to set forth a legal basis upon which to have them held. I'm troubled. I'm very troubled.
Okay. Well, I would say that the standard, though, that's been established in the case law is that he has to show bad faith or prejudice and evidence that the evidence possessed exculpatory value that was apparent before it was destroyed. When he hasn't even read the police report, he's just basically on a fishing expedition to keep any and all information that's out there regarding this case.
Knowing the nature of the witnesses that were interviewed, wouldn't he have a basis to make that determination? That perhaps they were exculpatory, and that's the reason they made the request.
Well, what I would like to point out is when you look at the timeline of the case, Detective Merrick testifies that this police report is a living document. It went through several different changes. At the time the finalized document was approved, it was January 17th. That witness statement that respondent relies upon about Briggs, where his statements flipped, that statement was not in existence. At the evidentiary hearing, the respondent presented Detective Merrick with two different versions of the police report, essentially, an incident report, which had witness Briggs' statement correctly put in there, that he heard the door and then the gunshot. And then he presented him with the finalized police report, which was approved 5 weeks after defendant filed his motion, and that is the report that had the witness statement flipped. So it would have been impossible for the detectives to know that there was an apparent exculpatory value at the time the notes were destroyed, because that finalized report didn't exist yet. Previous versions of the reports which were in the file that respondent had that witness statement in the way that was consistent with how that witness testified.
Okay. Ms. Clemens, a couple of issues I'm concerned about in the interest of time. First of all, for the student's edification, the judge dismissed this murder charge before it went to trial. And if the Supreme Court agrees with what the judge did, the defendant can't be retried for the murder. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So it's a very important issue for both sides we need to take a look at. My concern is this, is the standard of review. In this particular case, Judge Walsh had an evidentiary hearing regarding these allegations and concluded that there was bad faith on the part of the state and that the defense suffered prejudice. Now, as you know, in the Supreme Court, we have to give deference to what the judge does because the judge hears the facts, and we don't. We just hear these arguments today. Why should we not give deference to the judge, even if maybe the seven of us would disagree with the judge if we had heard the case, but we have to give that deference to her? How do you overcome that?
Well, I would say that her findings of bad faith was not supported by the record, and her findings of prejudice were not supported by the record. I know she relied a lot on the U.S. v. Bowl case, which is a federal case, and the facts of that case are completely distinguishable from the facts that we have. And most of this case law is dealing with a piece of physical evidence that is destroyed and we can no longer get back. Here, the witnesses are still alive. We don't have a situation where you can't talk to those witnesses, refresh the recollection with what was said in the police report, talk to the interviewer, and kind of recreate what happened.
She considered the Bowl factors, but isn't that somewhat reflected in the Howard case as well?
If you could just refresh
Howard
my recollection.
Howard versus State 95, Nevada 580. If you're familiar with it, if not, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I, off the top of my head, I did read a lot of the cases, and I can't remember that one. But in the Bowl case, that was dealing with a radio tower where the tower legs were alleged to be made with faulty materials. And there were specific things in that case that's very different from ours. The first is that when the charge basically is that those defendants were improperly constructed these tower legs, the main piece of evidence that's going to prove or disprove that are those tower legs themselves, which were destroyed. The defendants in that case had also requested access to those legs even before prosecution began in that case. Here, the witnesses that we're talking about are three basically collateral witnesses that the state would likely not even call if this case was retried. The one witness didn't believe that the person the police had stopped was known as BP, that's the defendant's moniker, and the other two witnesses had little to nothing to say of relevance, which is why their interviews were not recorded. Any important witness that had things to say about the case, those interviews were recorded and transcribed. So we don't have, our main linchpin of this case are not those three witnesses. The other thing is that the-
Let's suppose, counsel, that in a different case, they were three very essential witnesses, and we don't protect the rights of the defendant to have this information in your case, and therefore it becomes common practice that cases can be controlled or manipulated, if you will, by destruction of certain statements. Do we need to be concerned about that?
I don't believe so, because when it is, especially in a case like of this magnitude, when you have important witnesses, it's good police practice, and it's important for them to document, you know, what the witnesses are saying, to tape record them, to have them do written statements, to do a transcription of those statements if it's something that's going to be a linchpin or a big piece of evidence in the case. I think the reason why that wasn't done with these three witnesses is that they were merely kind of filling in the gaps of the investigation. They didn't provide any evidence, either good or bad. Jen Cook, the manager, did say that I don't recognize that person as BP. That is arguably exculpatory, and that was put into the report. So to say that Detective Merrick was hiding exculpatory evidence, yet he included exculpatory evidence in one of the witnesses where there wasn't a recorded interview, it's almost like the district court and the respondent were taking the parts of Detective Merrick's testimony that supported them and agreed with that and disregarded other parts of his testimony, such as he incorporated everything from his notes into that report and destroyed them according to regular protocol, just threw that out the window because it didn't support their theory.
I have two questions.
Sure.
On that point. Did Detective Merrick know about the Justice Court order?
I was not the prosecutor that did the Justice Court arraignment or handled the preliminary hearing. It's my understanding from reading the transcripts that the prosecutor believes that she did communicate a request to Detective Merrick. I can't really speak exactly to that because Detective Merrick testified. He remembers having a conversation at the preliminary hearing, either in or out of court, about notes. So I can't really answer that question.
All right. And then the second question is when the discussion with the judge occurred about the protocol of Metro to retain notes or discard notes, was there any written policy that provided for the destruction or the disposition of detectives' notes?
In the district court, is that
yes.
What you're referring to? Yes. Detective Merrick said he doesn't recall offhand a written policy, but he would have to check the manual. So it wasn't clear whether or not it was a written policy or a common practice.
So returning to Justice Givens' question, when we look at this case and assess it from the point of view of the trial judge, the trial judge basically did not have any information from Metro showing that there was a policy concerning the destruction of notes, as Merrick claimed. And as far as she could tell, it appeared as though Merrick, at least from an inference, had information that the notes were to be preserved.
He didn't know if there was a written policy, and he said it's common practice once they, in the department, once they incorporate their notes into the finalized report and that's reviewed, then the notes are shredded. So that's something that every officer does in that police department.
Despite any request to preserve the notes and that they may contain exculpatory information.
No, he said if he had been contacted by our office to preserve the notes, he would have done so, but our position is that the Justice Court couldn't do that.
And despite this being a murder case?
Well, the Justice Court could not order us to do that, so that's why.
No, but they requested that the notes be preserved, and the Justice Court indicated that they actually acknowledged they couldn't order you, but put the office on notice that the notes were to be preserved and perhaps could be exculpatory.
Yes. They put us on notice, but being on notice in our position is not the same as being ordered. So I'm going to.
But why would you take a chance on a murder case?
I mean, they have to show. The main thing is they have to show that the material has an apparent exculpatory value. By filing a stock motion that's inapplicable, there was no showing of that whatsoever.
So you're saying there's nothing specific to indicate the exculpatory nature of those notes?
Correct.
Okay.
Ms. Clements, did you want to reserve?
Yes, yeah. The rest of my time.
What I'm going to do is we ask.
I have a question.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Ms. Clements, I think the students would be interested in knowing what type of punishment this defendant was facing in the murder case.
He was facing a whole range of punishment, 10
so
to 20.
The range.
Yeah, 10 to 25, up to life. Mr. Silverstein probably is more familiar with that because it's been several years since I've seen this case, and I don't do murder cases right now, so I don't want to give them false information on that.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll give you your 3 minutes in rebuttal since we had a lot of questions, and we'll add 2 minutes to Mr. Silverstein's time to equalize the timeout. So if you give him 17 minutes, Tracy. Okay, Mr. Silverstein, you may.
And when you start, could you answer the question that Ms. Clemens was unable to answer about what this man was facing?
Yes, Justice.
And the various degrees.
Yes. Thank you, and may it please the Court. Let me first answer that question. My client was charged with first-degree murder. He was facing life without the possibility of parole. He could have gotten a 20-to-life sentence. He could have also gotten a 20-year to 50-year sentence. But he was facing life without the possibility of parole in this case.
Is that a firm thing, life without the possibility of parole, or can the governor or the pardons board change it to life with the possibility of parole?
Life without the possibility of parole in the state of Nevada means life without the possibility of parole. So there would have been no possibility of commutation. May it please the Court, I agree with Ms. Clemens that this is not a situation of hiding the ball. I would have preferred it to have been a situation of hiding the ball because then the ball could have been ordered to have been turned over at a later time and I could have seen it. This was a case of shred the ball, destroy the ball, make sure the defense can never see the ball.
Is it true that your office does blanket requests for the notes?
I do.
Despite whether or not there's an exculpatory. So rather than specifically in this case, making the statement, they're making the argument that there's some exculpatory material in this particular case, your office makes a blanket request in every case.
The reason...
Whether there's exculpatory notes, whether there's notes at all.
Well, the reason for that is at the time of receiving the case, there's no way to know in which case the notes may be potentially exculpatory. So
but,
it's this...
But you do interviews with your clients.
Well, I don't.
You know what your witness.
I haven't interviewed the client. This was at initial arraignment. This was the first day of the case. So I hadn't interviewed the client at all about the facts of the case. I had no police report. I barely had a criminal complaint.
So how can you make the. Let's go ahead.
This case is about the destruction of evidence. I asked for it. I specifically requested it. A justice court warned the state about the legal consequences of destroying it, and they destroyed it anyway.
Well, let's take up that point. In deciding this case, it's an important legal question. In Mortensen versus State, this court said that the orders of the Justice Court, even if they provide notice that you're supposed to, the state is supposed to retain the evidence of the notes, is not evidence of bad faith on the part of the state. Is, in deciding this case, is it necessary for this court to overturn Mortensen?
I believe Mortensen to be distinguishable for the following reason. In Mortensen, the party that destroyed the evidence in Mortensen was actually the co-defendant. The evidence was released out of state custody and given to the co-defendant. The court was asked to ask the co-defendant personally not to destroy the evidence.
Well, you're distinguishing it on the basis of who destroyed the notes. The legal principle in Mortensen says that if the justice court issues an order and places the state on notice to retain information or a party, that that is not evidence of bad faith.
I would dispute the conclusion that as a matter of law, that can never show bad faith. I think it's one factor that can be assessed in the bad faith determination. I think it's one of the factors the trial court in this case assessed in that determination. I think that it varies with facts and circumstances. And I think putting a prosecutor on notice that this evidence is important and that it's been requested is certainly something that the court can take into consideration. The question isn't whether this court would have done the same. The question is whether it's within the trial court's discretion to believe that it that there was evidence of bad faith.
And your bad faith argument, though, again, going back to the issue of in every single case, there's a blanket request to destroy the notes. How can you make that argument that in this particular case it was bad faith when you make that request in every case?
Because the
so does every case, if there's a destruction of notes, become a bad faith issue?
If there is exculpatory value to the notes that should have been known at the time they were destroyed, absolutely. And I believe that to be the law, that if the state knows that these notes are potentially of exculpatory value, they
But again, that undermines your argument if you make the request in every single case. And you admitted or you conceded that you hadn't had an opportunity to talk to your client, so you really didn't know if it was exculpatory or not.
But the state knew.
But the state claims that it was not exculpatory, that it was merely, if you will, filler.
The trial court believes that, at least with respect to the notes of Jennifer Cook's interview, there was obvious exculpatory value, being that this was the only witness who told the police that my client wasn't the man they were looking for. It was the only witness who said that. It's obviously exculpatory
counsel,
value.
Counsel, in that argument, and whether it's comes in or not, allegedly Mr. Banks, with his second interview to the police, confessed to the shooting. Is that a correct statement?
That is he made admissions, correct.
And how can it be bad faith and a problem with respect to the notes when the witness you just mentioned is available to testify and would repeat, presumably, in trial, the same thing that was said to the detective
about
the whereabouts of your client?
I don't believe police and myself agree on many things. I think the police and myself would agree that an interview with a witness months after the fact is no reasonable alternative to an interview immediately after the incident. That is not a reasonable alternative.
Did this witness testify in the evidentiary hearing in front of Judge Walsh?
No.
So how is it that Judge Walsh could arrive at the conclusion that the testimony or the statements in destroyed notes were exculpatory?
Because those notes were the only record of these conversations. They were the only way to know what these exculpatory witnesses had to say immediately after the incident. There is no reasonable replacement for them. Interviewing them 2 months later after their memories have had a chance to fade, that's not a reasonable alternative.
Where did the information come from that made it appear as though she had said something to the detective that was exculpatory? She didn't testify in the evidentiary hearing, as you just noted. So where did the information come from that indicated this witness had exculpatory information?
Well, the police report does mention that Jennifer Cook said that my client was not the man. However, the police spoke with Jennifer Cook for a lot more than that one sentence. They spoke with her for 30 minutes to an hour.
The exculpatory information, Mr. Silverstein, that you are seeking in the notes was contained in the police report, and Detective Merrick said, I transferred information from the notes to the police report.
But Justice, that is the speculation in this case. That is the speculation that all the exculpatory
possibly
information...
Possibly so, but under the jurisprudence, who has the burden to demonstrate exculpatory evidence that's been withheld?
I think that I believe my burden is to show that there was potentially exculpatory value in those notes, and I believe that burden was met. I think it's the state's burden to preserve that evidence, especially when they've been put on notice to do so by a court.
Well, I just want to be clear. The exculpatory information that you know about is contained in the police report. So we are really speculating about whether there is any exculpatory evidence contained in these notes at all, correct?
I cannot agree with that statement, Justice. I cannot agree.
Then do you have any information, any witness, any testimony from anybody that indicates that there is something exculpatory in the notes that were destroyed?
The single statement that was transferred from the notes to the police report was exculpatory. In my opinion...
Can you just answer my question? Do you have any evidence, written, testimony, or otherwise, that there is information in the destroyed notes that was exculpatory?
Justice, the evidence that would allow me to answer that question is in the bottom of a Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department paper shredder. I would love to be able to answer that question. The state has disallowed me from doing so. I would love to be able to answer that question.
I return then to the question. It's your burden. So the question then is, are you asking this court to revisit our jurisprudence in this area and say that the burden shifts to the state in some respect?
I don't believe any change in the law is necessary to decide this case. I don't believe any change in the law is necessary to decide the trial court did not abuse its discretion here.
Well, don't you think we should clarify Mortensen? Mortensen was a 1999 case. This is 2014. Should we clarify it since Mortensen was a co-defendant who destroyed documents rather than a police officer?
To the extent that Mortensen can be read to say that if a court orders a prosecutor to preserve evidence and the prosecutor does not, that cannot be bad faith, to the extent that Mortensen says that proposition, I believe it does need to be reconsidered.
But it's why isn't it completely distinguishable from this? There was no order by the Justice Court. There's an acknowledgement the Justice Court can't make such an order. And is it common practice for the Justice Courts to, when you make your blanket request, is it a common practice for the Justice Courts to say, well, don't destroy anything? I can't order you, but you're on notice. Don't destroy anything.
That's been my experience. I believe it would be common practice in any court to tell a party not to destroy evidence. I was talking to this case with my wife. She's a civil lawyer. I don't know the civil law. She told me about litigation preservation letters. I didn't know this. There's a letter in civil cases that are given out telling people not to destroy evidence. I didn't even ask the prosecutor to draft a letter. All she had to do in this case was make a phone call, send an email. The detective testified he would have preserved the notes. All he had to do was...
Is that negligence or bad faith?
It's bad faith. It's absolutely bad faith because the court...
And not negligence.
Because the court warned the prosecutor that if these notes are destroyed, there may be a legal issue involved. The prosecutor knew these were being requested, knew or should have known of the potentially exculpatory value, and let them be destroyed anyway.
But you don't know the exculpatory value at that point, so how can you claim that they did?
Again... The evidence that I would need to prove the claim to that extent is in a Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department paper shredder, and I do not believe that it is fair to require me to tell you the contents of notes that the state destroyed, that I tried to stop the destruction, did everything I could within my power to stop that destruction, and then hold me accountable for the fact that I can't tell you what was in the notes that have been shredded. Well,
Go ahead, Mike.
I was just going to say, what are you going to do in future cases if we rule against you as far as preserving... police notes. What are you going to do?
If the court rules against me, even though it may not be the announced rule, the practical rule of reversal will be that dismissal is simply not allowed for destruction of evidence in the state of Nevada. Because if the circumstances of this case did not rise to the level within the trial court's discretion to dismiss, trial courts have no discretion to dismiss. And that will be the practical effect of a reversal of this decision, is that cases simply will never be dismissed for destruction of evidence.
Well,
you still have bad faith, and the other option is or prejudice. What's the prejudice?
The prejudice here is that the notes that were destroyed were the only record of the only witnesses in the case who were of potentially exculpatory value to my defense. Everyone who had anything remotely bad to say about my client, not only notes but audio recording, anybody who had anything potentially good to say The notes are now in the shredder. That's the problem. It's not a matter of certain witnesses. It's the fact that the good witnesses for the state get recorded. My witnesses get shredded.
But they were available to you at the time of trial. Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
Those same witnesses were available to you at the time of trial. Is that correct?
Presumably. Presumably they would have been. However, like I said, I don't believe that cross-examination at trial is a reasonable substitute for their first impressions, the present sense impressions made at the time.
I'm glad you're going there, because to me one of the questions I have is a dismissal is what in the civil arena is called a case-terminating sanction. It is the end. There will be no prosecution for an alleged murder by your client. In the civil arena, typically alternative sanctions are considered, and they're tailored to the particular offense and the facts of the case and the nature of the evidence that may have been lost. For example, physical evidence that is destroyed deliberately can really put people in a world of hurt on trying to analyze what happened and how to prove either their case or their defense. Notes that are incorporated into another written statement that's typed up and clear, I mean, my handwritten notes are horrible, is a horse of a different color. So to me, the question in this case is, why do we go straight to dismissal on a single witness's notes, and I know there are three, but the main one is Jennifer, whose notes were typed up, the conversation with her, the notes were typed up, it was in the police report that she would put your client someplace else or what have you. You could call her. The court could say the state was destroyed the officer's notes and we're going to instruct you, jury, that you should give an adverse inference to the state or whatever on this point. But that would be short of actually throwing out the charge. And that's what interests me in the legal arena, translating civil to criminal, and you brought that up.
Understood. First of all, I agree with the justice that in most situations the police report is going to be a substitute for the notes. But in this case it wasn't. And the district court specifically found that the police report in this case could not be relied upon to be an adequate substitute because of the material misrepresentation made in that police report about what one of the other witnesses had said about the order of a knock on the door versus a gunshot. That made the police report unreliable as a substitute. That fact won't be present in most cases. That fact was a big part of the reason, I believe, that the trial court reached its decision. It's outlined in the 8-page order. Was there another?
Alternative sanctions, lesser sanctions than dismissal of the charge. There are other things that people can do at trial to explain to the jury what happened and why those notes aren't there and why it might matter to your client.
I think I've already addressed as to cross-examination of those witnesses or re-interviewing those witnesses.
Well, not to my satisfaction. Maybe you could do a little more on that.
Well, the suggestion was actually made in the state's brief that I could simply call up the police officer and then call up the witnesses and get everybody together and make sure that everybody was on the same page. I mean, that's not a reasonable...
Well, Mr. Silver, let me throw out some other idea again, the court hit, because I kind of was intrigued in Justice Pickering's question. I mean, let's say if this were a civil case, what probably would happen is that the judge would permit a jury instruction to the jury saying, you can presume that these notes are missing, and you can presume that, or draw an adverse inference, that they are harmful to the state, you know, like that. They give that kind of instruction in a civil case, and you can argue that, but it's not, it doesn't throw the case out. The case can still go to the jury. So I think that might be an issue that we might have some interest in. So do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. Historically, this court has accorded substantial deference to the trial court, substantial deference to the trial court, even when the chosen remedy of the trial court is not the normal course of business. Just because the ruling may have been atypical does not make it an abuse of discretion. Justice Perigeri asked a question earlier, why take a chance? Ask Ms. Clemens, why did you take a chance? The answer to that question is they took the chance because they knew no court would ever dismiss a case. They knew the trial court wouldn't dismiss the case. That's why they took the chance. And perhaps the trial court wanted to send the message not only to correct the prejudice to my client, but to deter future violations. And that is perfectly reasonable for the trial court to craft a remedy that would not only affect Mr. Banks, but make sure that the next time this happens, the prosecutor picks up the phone.
Very well. Thank you so much, Mr. Silverstein. We appreciate that. Ms. Clemens, you'll have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court, the first thing I want to touch on is that there was no prejudice in this case. To demonstrate prejudice, the respondent has to show that it was reasonably anticipated the destroyed evidence would be material and exculpable, and we've discussed a lot about that this morning. There was nothing specific in his stock motion, and there was nothing in the police report until the finalized report came out well after the notes were destroyed that would put anybody on notice that possibly these notes had any exculpatory value.
Well, let's say hypothetically we agreed with you on the prejudice prong, but okay, the other prong is bad faith, and if the court concludes there's bad faith, the case is still dismissed. Why wasn't there bad faith here based on the motion being filed, the destruction here, the potential exculpatory evidence? Don't we have to give deference to the district court on the bad faith issue?
Well, I would say there wasn't bad faith. I would agree that even if you find the justice court did order us, there's definitely some negligence going on from the prosecuting attorney's perspective. But that is not the same as bad faith. There's been other cases where there's been a pending discovery request, and that hasn't been relayed to the police department, and courts have not found that to be bad faith. The time that the Detective Merrick found out about these notes was 2 days after they were destroyed. It wasn't months and months later. And when he destroyed them in accordance with their normal protocol, which other cases have said, if it's destroyed in their normal protocol, that's not bad faith. In fact, Bowl, the case that the district court relied upon, even says that an innocent explanation includes mere negligence or following protocol, which is what I would submit happened in this case.
Whose bad faith do we look at? Do we look at the detective's bad faith? In the sense that, well, he didn't know, or do we look at the state's bad faith in the sense that, well, they were put on notice and didn't relay that fact to the detective?
I would say that that's one of the things that we brought up in our brief, that it's clear that the police officer's knowledge is imputed to the state, but it's not clear as whether it's the reverse around, that the state's knowledge is imputed to the detective. In this case, I would say the detective did not act in bad faith because by the time he was told about the notes, they were already destroyed, and the prosecuting attorney relayed the request at the prelim, which was a couple weeks later, and at that point they had already been destroyed, and it's not like they were destroying the notes to hide anything. This is part of standard practice. Everything's incorporated into the report, as Detective Merrick had stated in his testimony numerous times, and these were insignificant witnesses. They were not witnesses that the state's going to rely upon to secure a murder conviction.
Would you agree that if we did reverse and it went to trial, that the defense would be entitled to the instruction that Justice Pickering and Justice Gibbons were talking about adverse inference on the destruction of the notes?
I do not agree that it rose to the level of gross negligence. I think it rose to the level of negligence where the remedy would be that the respondent can cross-examine the detective and the witnesses. The reason why it's my position it's not gross negligence is that the Justice Court did not have the power to order us to preserve the notes, and that Mr. Silverstein did not make any specific findings about why the nature of these notes were apparently exculpable at the time they were destroyed.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We appreciate your arguments. What we'd like to do now is normally just go on to our next case if we're up in the regular Supreme Court calendar, but the students have heard the arguments here of each side, and what I want to do is throw it open to questions for the students to ask questions to the court, or I encourage you to ask questions to the attorneys for the state and for Mr. Banks about facts of the case and reasons for their arguments, and you get a better handle on what's going on with this particular case. So kind of put yourself in the position of the Supreme Court. You have to decide this case, and you might need some more information here. What questions would you go ahead and ask the attorneys here? Anybody like to start on that, to ask a question? Oh, yeah, I don't know if you do. That's a good question. Yeah, you don't have to. It's okay. I mean, it's not a. It's just we wanted to give you that opportunity if you'd like to do that. Okay, we have a question here. Yes. Come on up, Julie. What's your question then, like that? You can stand up, and hope I know you can kind of maybe speak towards your colleagues out here. What's your question? We'll see if we can hear you then. I'm not sure I heard the question.
The question was, do you believe that the notes were thrown out on purpose? And I think it was addressed to Mr. Silverstein.
Okay. Yeah, I think, too, it's an interesting point. I think Mr. Silverstein may have answered that during his argument, kind of his perspective on what happened. So we'll defer to your recollections to what he said during his oral argument on that particular point. Yes, any other questions?
There's one there, Mark.
I'm sorry, where is it, Mike?
Right in the middle.
Okay. Yes, is there a question? Come on, please stand up, and if you could.
Fellow in the blue shirt.
Blue shirt? You're kind of in the middle. Maybe talk as loud as you can so maybe all your colleagues out here in the audience can hear the question, too.
In your build-up against the spreading of the nose,
Dan, go ahead. If you want to go to the microphone, then on that one.
I mostly just deal with the prosecutors in court. I don't go to the police department. I don't talk to them. The prosecutor is their representative in court. And when the prosecutor is asked to do something, where I come from, that means the police department's order to do it.
Okay. Thank you for that question. Yes.
And in fact, Mr. Silverstein, isn't it true that you can use a person's statement against them at the time of trial to say they said one thing here and something different subsequently?
Yes, that's also true. If they testified at trial and said something different on the stand, let's say they changed their story, and now all of a sudden they're saying things bad about me. Well, that initial interview, those notes, I could impeach them, meaning I could point out what was in the first statement to show that they might be lying at trial. So they're important for more than one reason.
Okay. Ms. Clemens, perhaps, you heard a lot of questions directed to Mr. Silverstein. Could you maybe get up and comment about your thoughts on some of these questions that were asked today from the state's perspective? Folks, what we're going to do now is take a question. Oh, I think we had another. We may have time for one more question if we could, and then we'll have some more questions. I think, gentlemen, I see.
He's had his hand up quite a bit.
Sir, with the one in the middle that's raising your hand, if you'd stand up and give us your question, please. We'll have more time for questions after our next arguments as well. But go ahead. Okay, Mr. Silverstein, if you could take.
Exculpatory evidence means evidence in my favor. It means evidence to defend the case. So if there's a trial where there's no exculpatory evidence and it's all been destroyed, it would be a pretty easy trial for the state. That's why the state has the obligation to preserve. They have an obligation not to destroy anything that could be favorable, because it's not fair for the police to take all the good stuff and then destroy all the bad stuff. And that's the problem here, is that all the good stuff that the state
Oh, including his confession?
Well, his confession was okay.
That doesn't happen.
Okay, well, I think that was kind of an extraneous comment here that I'd like to have. Mr. Cohn from the Public Defender's Office, did you have something you'd like to say? Thank you, Mr. Cohn. We appreciate your comments. Let's do this. We're going to take a break.